I'm calling Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is January 22nd, and it's 3:30 p.m. Welcome back to Senate Resources. We had a great break, but here we are again, ready to do the state's work. Present today with us is Senator McGuire, Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Giesel. Excused absence is Senator Dyson. I believe Senator French will be joining us shortly. So, we're starting out today with a department overview with the Department of Environmental Conservation. And so they will be reviewing the department, but I also specifically asked Commissioner Hartig to touch on the Fukushima effects possibly on our fish and how that's being monitored. I've had a lot of questions by constituents, and I think Representative Chris Tompkins is going to be joining us later, and he's been looking at that issue too, so I wanted the Commissioner to address that also. So welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Giesel and members of the committee. My name is Larry Harty, Commissioner, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and it's good to be back. I will cover the department overview today, talk about each of our divisions and some of their key programs and some of the challenges that each of the divisions are facing. And I will talk about the marine debris and along with that the radiation concerns from the public and what the department and others are doing to address those concerns. So we have a PowerPoint. You all should have copies of those. And I don't know how the chair wants to do it, but I was thinking that after I talk with about each division, I'd be sure and take a break and make sure there's no question before I go on to the next division, but it's however you'd like to do it.
That sounds great, Commissioner.
Okay, but I'll pause then just to make sure that I haven't missed any questions or advice. We welcome advice. Okay, DEC's mission, stated very simply, is protect human health and the environment. And since this is the Resource Committee, I thought I would just spend one moment talking about our nexus to some of the other departments, particularly the resource agencies of the state. On the human health side, sometimes people look at human health. Isn't that health and social service? Yes, it is, but we work closely with them. I mean, they have the epidemiologists, they have the doctors over there, the nurses and stuff. But we look at the environmental side of things, what in the environment could impact human health. But where we see things that we have questions about what is the impact, then we refer to them. And for instance, like on fish tissue monitoring that we'll talk about when we talk about environmental health and our environmental health lab, we sample tissue and fish around the state. We find out what's in that tissue, and then we turn that information over to them to evaluate, well, do we need to issue any food consumption advisories, you know, like for pregnant women or other members of the sensitive population. So we work hand-in-hand with our human health side of things with them. And I'll give some other examples, particularly when we talk to environmental health. On the protecting the environment side, we work most closely, I believe, with Department of Fish and Game and DNR. For example, in Fish and Game, they have the wild animals. DEC has animal care. Domestic animals, animal health in the domestic population. We're concerned about zoonotic diseases, animals and or disease animal populations that could spring to human populations, those sort of things. And so, you know, if we're seeing a disease in wild animals, we might be concerned about domestic animals, so we're talking with them. Water quality, you know, we certainly talk with Fish and Game if we think there might be impacts to fish, you know, in terms of the water quality concerns that we deal with. So there's ongoing dialogue there. With DNR, they're the land manager, and so, for instance, we talk with them quite a bit on reclamation. Like, say you had a large mine project, and the mine project ends, they're going to have to continue water treatment. Well, we would look at a bond for water treatment costs going forward. DNR would look at bonding for land reclamation, putting the land contours back, taking care of the dam that might still be there, that sort of thing. So we work closely with them on how to structure the reclamation requirements around that mine. So we're just one among the resource agencies, but sometimes people don't see all that interaction that takes place. So when we say human health and the environment, we're just part of the picture. We work with all these other agencies. Going to our divisions, we have five divisions. These are in alphabetical order, and that's the way I'll cover them today because that's the easiest way for me to remember them. But our Division of Administration, just what they say, they take care of the administrative stuff. They're the IT people, the human resources, budget and finance, accounting, The one thing that they have that may not come to mind is the Environmental Crimes Unit. That's just two people. But the idea of the division administration is they're really providing service to the other four divisions. And the environmental crimes, they look at all different types of environmental crimes, whether it arise in the air quality context, food safety, which might be an environmental health, or midnight dumper situation that might involve SPAR. So they get involved with all the different divisions, so that's why it's housed in that division that serves all the others. Other thing that one of the challenges that kind of department-wide, but it's being addressed primarily through the division administration is trying to move more towards a GIA-based way of maintaining our records and talking with each other, both within the division or in the department outside the division, referencing things by GIS. And so, if you have something occurring at a particular site, say like a spill, we can go right and see what are the fish openings, when are they going to open, what fisheries. We might be able to see, is that a salmon fishing spawning area that needs to be protected a certain way. But we can access all sorts of information. Are there any wastewater dischargers in that area? It's just a way of being able to talk with each other within the divisions and among the departments. So that's something that we're looking at progressing on. One of the other challenges, and I've mentioned this thing just about every year, in the department, and it's shared with other departments in state government, it's even outside state government in the private industry, and that's just the demographics of the population and trying to maintain the workforce and the continuity of your operations as you have an aging workforce and trying to replace people with a kind of a declining pool of applicants. And for within DEC, the last figure I saw for the new employee at DEC, it's in the 40s. I mean, that seems unusual. And so I sometimes hear, well, the way we're going to solve the budget problem is we're just going to hire younger people. So our existing people are retired, and we'll go hire people right out of college. Well, there's people who aren't there. There's not enough of them, is our experience. And so it's easier said than done. But we are seeing a lot more retirements. We've lost a lot of people in our spill prevention and response job last year, in that division last year, including the director, Lear Diedrich, that had 37 years experience. And so it's hard to replace those people. It's going to just be an ongoing challenge. So we have to look at how do we maintain continuity of services and operations in light of that. So those are some of the different divisions we'll talk about, air quality, environmental health, spill, prevention, response, and water from here. Our air quality division, they're the smallest of the five divisions. And just as their name implies, they look at setting air quality standards. They look at issuing air permits. We'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. They monitor air quality issues, look at how we maintain air quality in places like Fairbanks that are experiencing problems. And one of the larger tasks we've had recently is just with a slew of new proposed federal rules out of Washington, D.C. with EPA on air quality, that is just tracking those and trying to figure out what their impact would be in Alaska and commenting on those rules. And when those rules are adopted, looking at ways of trying to implement those in Alaska that makes sense. And I'll give some examples of that. But as EPA knows, every discussion with us starts out, well, Alaska's different, and let me explain it to you. They understand that, and by and large, they get it. But on the air quality side, that comes up regularly, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. On the air permitting program, there's several different types of permits that we issue, some under strictly state law and some under federal law, the Clean Air Act. The permits under the Clean Air Act tend to be the larger emitters, like power plants, industrial-type facilities, refineries, that sort of thing. And they have the large emitters have more complicated requirements. Sometimes facilities will purposely try to stay below certain trigger levels as they don't get into the more strenuous federal requirements, and they'll take what's called owner-requested limits that we can put in permits that'll limit their hours of operation or emissions to keep them under a more simple permitting strategy of the state. But the larger facilities, they fall into two big areas, construction permits and what are called Title V operating permits. And construction permits, these are probably the toughest ones we issue. These are for large new facilities. Like, say, for a gas line, you need a liquefaction plant on the North Slope. So what's that going to look like? Where is it going to be? What kind of the emissions are going to look like? What's the meteorology in the area that will affect the distribution of those contaminants in the air, and how quickly will they be able to meet air quality standards? And that's what we work on permit applicants on a construction permit. And that can be a very complicated process. These permits, that's usually where the big problems are solved, in the construction permit, before we ever get to an operating permit. The construction permits, one of the federal requirements is associated with that. You have to have a year of meteorological data. I think it's 6 months or more. I can't remember the exact number of pollutant data before you can even consider the application. And so there's larger lead time in these permits. We have to talk with people that might be building these type of facilities early on. For instance, we're having a lot of discussions with ADA right now about what a liquefaction plant might look like, where it might go, and, you know, so we can try to get a head start on that. The critical thing on these construction permits, under federal law, you can't begin construction until you have the permit. And so it isn't like you can start construction, but before you start emitting, you don't need the permit. You can't even start construction. And so it's a very key permit. Often it's one of the big drivers on the timing of a large construction project that has air emissions. The way I would describe our air permitting program is that it's a fairly mature program. We've had primacy for decades. The people there have a lot of good experience. It makes us vulnerable to those retirements I mentioned, but it also means that we have some very skilled people. So one of our big objectives right now in the Air Quality Division is to capitalize on all that experience and knowledge that we do have there, and try to put systems in place, processes, forms, you name it, management systems, everything we can to capture, you know, that experience and that knowledge, so that it can go to the next generation, the people that are coming along, you know, as the next managers. We don't have to go back and try to recreate that. It puts a lot of demand on those managers because they're trying to do that knowledge transfer and trying to be the lead for the department in some of these management systems, computerizing the process for putting permits out, tracking permits. So like people make one application and everybody has access to that application in the division. They don't have to go ask for the information twice. They know how to get it. People can track where their permits are online, know where we're at on the permit process, what to expect next, these kind of things. So it's in some ways there are others that are doing that within the division, but that's, I kind of see the leading edge there. One of the big challenges that we got in terms of air quality is in the Fairbanks area. We're working closely with the people up there, with the interior delegation here in the building. We're trying to meet the needs of the people up there. We recognize, as I'm sure Senator Bishop could elaborate on, the high energy costs that people face in Fairbanks. You have a combination of factors in Fairbanks that have led to this problem. You have the high energy costs with people switching to wood as a way of a heating source. Then you have the winter air and the inversions that trap, you know, that the cold air that traps the smoke near the ground where people breathe it. And then you have the EPA rules, and they have a national health-based rule for PM2.5, which is 2.5 microns, very small size, very small particles that are created when you combust hydrocarbons, and that can get deep into the lungs and cause health problems, even in healthy individuals, but particularly in people that have preconditions like asthma that can be affected by this. And so we're required by federal law to get the area into attainment with this national standard that they don't currently meet, this health-based standard. And we have deadlines for putting a plan out there on how we're going to do it as a state, get into attainment. And there's consequences, there's sanctions under federal law if we don't get a plan in time, and there's sanctions if we don't come into attainment in time. And then there's interest groups standing behind EPA that have lawsuits filed and lawsuits threatened, you know, that pile onto these potential consequences. And so we're trying to meet everybody's needs and at the same time work with the governor and the legislature to promote bringing natural gas and propane into the area, which ultimately is part of the solution, a big part of the solution, both on the energy costs and the air quality side of things. It's just that the federal deadlines arise before you could practically get natural gas and propane and all the conversions and all that done. And even then, end of the day, wood still may be a supplemental source for some people, because even propane and natural gas is going to cost something. Not everybody will be able to afford to convert immediately. So it's going to be an ongoing issue. But we're working hard to meet everybody's needs up there. We appreciate the legislature's patience and their help in helping to fund some of the programs up there, like the stove change-out program. The other thing to note here, though, is that this isn't the only place in the state that is facing PM 2.5 challenges. Here in Juneau, the Mendenhall Valley, they have inversions, too. They were at risk of going into non-attainment, but the city borough of Juneau down here already had a program in place that's incorporated in DEC's requirements that allow them to do burn bans here, which you can't practically do in Fairbanks because you can't turn the heat off in Fairbanks in the wintertime. But here in Juneau, they actually do institute burn bans at times so they don't go into non-attainment and trigger these plan requirements and these sanctions. And so it's been successful here. Other parts of the state are kind of bumping up against it, like in the Butte area, up in the Mat-Su Valley. That's a place to watch. Even areas in the municipality of Anchorage. And the municipality of Anchorage has been active in trying to avoid going into non-attainment. Excuse me.
Would you mind if we had a question right now?
Oh, no problem. Okay. Your convenience.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. I just wanted to ask the question before we move past it while it's on our minds. Been up to Fairbanks, and people are very upset about this. You know, it's a way of life, and for people who have been living out there, and certainly it's the cost of energy. My question is threefold. The first is, don't we have sovereign immunity? If you're talking about litigation facing the state, that's number one. Number two, what are these fines that are associated with the Clean Air Act that are being threatened against us, if you could elaborate? And number three, is there any evidence in Alaska and in Fairbanks of this particulate matter damaging the lungs of Alaskans? Do we have any science that comes to here? Because a lot of times I feel that we have the federal government coming in and telling us what they have found based on studies. Senator Giesel referred to this earlier today, where it's sort of a set of hypotheticals, and then it gets sort of overlaid onto a place in Alaska. And my concern is just, is this really happening in Alaska?
Sure. Senator McGuire, through the chair, maybe I'll take those in reverse order if I miss one.
Okay.
Remind me, please. But in terms of the human health consequences, PM 2.5 has been studied a long time, and it's not something that would be, I would anticipate, have different impacts in Alaska than it would anywhere else. I mean, it's a problem around the world. That's the problem here in Beijing, China right now, is PM 2.5, and they're trying to deal with it. And their levels, I saw the other day, they were saying they were 300 and some, was it micrograms per cubic meter, whatever the measurement is. But I said, well, you see that in Fairbanks sometimes. You know, I mean, Fairbanks is up there, quite a ways up there. So it's not like they're just bumping up against the standard like maybe Butte is right now. Some days they really get in there. And then in some areas of town, it can be particularly concentrated depending on where the inversion is and how much smoke and how many stoves and boilers are in that particular area. So you may find spots in Fairbanks that are not that bad, but you'll find some that are really bad in terms of kind of world levels. In terms of health impacts, there was a study that was done. We can get you the information on that with health. I think it was with Health and Social Service because they're involved in this. You know, again, there's that nexus that I described earlier, working with us on this, and I think with the University of Alaska was involved. But what they found was that when you have high PM 2.5, the number of visits to the local hospital emergency room for respiratory-related diseases went up. There was a correlation there. Now, you don't have a huge population in Fairbanks, and this is always a problem in Alaska, is how strong a correlation can you make? Because you talk about the national standards, that's when you can deal with large populations of people, and so you have more statistical robustness, you know, to your surveys. And when you have a small population, it's just harder to make that connection. But the data, that's what it suggests, is that, yeah, there's a correlation, and it's consistent with what you see in other areas of the world. We have larger populations and more robust studies. But I just don't see, and we are very sensitive to the idea that Alaska is different, and I'll get into some instances where we do challenge EPA on those kind of questions. In terms of the federal immunity, I don't see that apply here at all. I mean, it's for instance, it's the Federal Clean Air Act under which these requirements arise, and all states are subject to it. And I can't think of any instance where the state would have immunity to federal law. And I haven't ever heard a challenge like that. And the thing I try to remind people, and this is hard, when they, like you say, they're so concerned about their energy costs, is we're not doing this just to make EPA happy or the federal government happy. We're doing it because there's real health concerns. Yeah. And some of the federal sanctions that we're talking about, if you're a federal agency and you're thinking about, well, do I bring more military people in, you know, to Fairbanks area, and I'm worried about health concerns. And if the area is not meeting Clean Air Act requirements, there's some of the sanctions are is there can't be a federal project that would support federal monies that would support a project that would make the problem worse in a non-attainment area. And so if you're talking military expansions or if you're talking military funding for other projects, you know, highway funds or whatever, it becomes problematic. There's also sanctions that can kick in that if there's a new discharger come in, even a private operation, it has to be, if they have new emissions, it has to be 2-for-1. In other words, you have to find, if for every increase of one, you have to find a decrease of 2 somewhere else. So they have to find somebody else that can decrease their emissions. One of the things that's going to happen in Fairbanks is we have a 2014 deadline to submit an approvable plan to EPA end of this year, 2014. And that plan has to show how the area is going to come into attainment by the end of 2015. That's not achievable because we really do need natural gas to get all the way. We can get a lot of the way with stove changeouts and instituting the DEC proposed performance standards for new stoves. Old stoves are grandfathered in, so there's no problem there with people with their existing stoves. But we'll still not be able to reach attainment by the end of 2015, so our plan from that sense is going to be deficient, and it's going to likely put us into what's called serious non-attainment under the Clean Air Act, and then that kicks in some other sanctions. We're waiting to see, because that is just brand new. The result of some federal litigation outside the state where EPA was found not to have been applying all the requirements of the Clean Air Act that they're supposed to for new PM 2.5 rules. And the serious non-attainment now is a new factor that comes into play. So it's going to be really hard for us to escape. And even EPA, who's been, we had the EPA administrator up here this summer, the new one, Gina McCarthy, who was in charge of the air program at EPA before she became the administrator. When Lisa Jackson left, one of her first visits was to Fairbanks, and I met with her in Anchorage, and then she went up to Fairbanks, and she said she was going to let the people know there that EPA is going to work with them. That they realize the uniqueness of Fairbanks is different than the rest of the country. And they are working with us to try to find accommodations here. But they're going to reach a roadblock, too, when they get sued. You know, if they don't find the state in serious non-attainment or they don't institute some of these sanctions, you know, the NGOs, the private litigants, can force them into it through the court system. So it's kind of like, well, even if we told EPA we're not going to do it, they'll get taken to court and the judge will tell them to do it. So it's kind of like, well, you know, this one, I think the writing's on the wall. I mean, we got to, and again, there's we just don't want to lose sight of the human health aspects. I mean, that gets back to that. So it's really hard to talk to federal agencies into saying, well, we just need more time. They'll understand the fuel costs, the time that it takes to get there. LNG is going to take some time. There is a solution site. The state's putting a lot of effort into LNG. It's a very real thing. You know, that is the solution. We need more time, and they're willing to go that direction, but they can't just ignore it because of the human health consequences, the legal requirements that are there that they have to meet, and the fact that any day a federal judge can force them into it, too. So I think I covered the sanctions. I think I talked about immunity, and I think I talked about the health consequences. But
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Bishop has a question.
Just a comment. Commissioner, I just want to end on that before we move on for Fairbanks, that help is on the way. And what I've seen, that this LNG truck gas project is going to hit 77 or over 75% of the non-attainment area, where the hardest hit areas with this gas. So everybody, EPA is aware of that, and I know that you're probably keeping them in the loop on that, that we're pedaling as fast as we all can.
Yep.
Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Senator Bishop, through the chair. Yeah, we're all working very hard on LNG, and that's going to be hopefully the ultimate solution, both for energy costs, energy security, and clean air. So that's the big challenge in the air division. There's other rural issues out there, dust in rural Alaska, but I'll just go ahead and move on to EPA rules. We hear a lot about greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants and new power plants under President Obama's climate change strategy. It gave EPA direction and deadlines to come up with new rules to try to lower emissions, because power plants, in the at least in the most of the United States, they could be a big contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. The Alaska is different in that our plants are a lot smaller than the ones outside, and they're responsible for percentage-wise and volume-wise a lot less of our greenhouse gas emissions in the state. DEC in the past has more recently looked at the greenhouse gas emission sources in the state, and where outside the state may be 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions might be from public power plants. Here it's a much, much smaller number. It's not one of the two top emitters like it would be elsewhere. It's likely, at least for the new plants that we would be below the limit that would trigger application of the new federal requirements that are being proposed. We're working on that with EPA to make sure that, and you know, if that's the case, then there won't be consequences to Alaska, at least right now. And on the new plants, it's pretty much the same, as we're looking at that to see whether any new rules that are proposed might impact things like a liquefaction plant, but we don't think so, you know, at this point, for a variety of reasons. But you know, our big plants on the North Slope, they're already using natural gas. That's their main fuel, and that's about as clean as you can get. You know, so going to the environmental health division. They're one of our larger divisions, but they're probably also the most diverse in what they do. I mean, it covers everything from restaurant inspections to shellfish farming, gooey ducks. It's the state vet. It's tattoo parlor inspections. It's public drinking water systems, landfills. I mean, and it goes on. It includes marine debris and radiation right now. So we'll get to that too, but it's really diverse. But the biggest problem is, or the biggest program is probably the drinking water side. Maybe the food safety side is pretty large too. And the food safety, we'll talk about this a little bit more detail. That I think the biggest challenge there is that what we're trying to do, it's kind of one of these basic things that EPA does, going back to protecting human health, is you want clean air, you want clean water. You want good sanitation, and you want safe, wholesome food. You don't want contaminants in your food. You don't want bacteria, the wrong bacteria growing in it. You know, and so people take those things for granted, but you can't. I mean, it doesn't take much to make food unsafe. And so we have responsibility for food safety within the state. If things get shipped out of state, that becomes the Federal Food and Drug Administration. We work closely with them. Sometimes we do their inspections for them, and they reimburse us for that. But we spend a lot of time watching out for food safety, and it's a pretty sophisticated program, and I'll get into that. But we have to when you look at food safety, some people think, well, it's just somebody with a checklist. They go in and they walk through the restaurant and they make sure the things are washed, people are washing their hands, and that sort of thing. But what they're really doing is they're looking at the whole process of what's going on there and whether it's a creating a situation where the types of contaminants, the type of microorganisms that you'd be worried about might grow, might flourish, might get into the food, might get in people's bodies. So it's an evaluation. You have to understand what the risks are and whether what's going on in there could create that risk. But the other thing we're trying to do in the program is not just have a bunch of people there with a checklist, but they should be able to go into the establishment and have a dialogue, you know, with the owners. Because if, particularly in the smaller establishments, whether it's restaurants or small operations trying to prepare some food for sale, they may not understand why we're doing what we're doing. So if you can sit there and explain to them, you know, when the shipment of food arrives, how do you handle it? How does it get into the refrigerator? Where do you store it in the refrigerator? How often do you check the temperature? Do you know why you need to do that? You know, how long do you leave it out? You know, how do you thaw it? I mean, you can have a dialogue about these things that can lead to food safety that are educational. You get compliance, and you have a happy customer at the end of the day. Customers, and so we're trying to go more that direction. But with food safety, I say one of the big challenges in Alaska is that you have things spread out so much, and in the rest of the country, you'd see counties more involved. You see county food inspectors, municipality inspects restaurants in the state, but everybody else, it's DEC doing it. And so you look at the whole state, and you think of how dispersed we are, and all these villages that have schools and lunch programs and you have camps out there that serve food to people. It's, you know, how do you handle it? And so we can't do all the inspections that we like to do. We're kind of below the level, well below the level FDA recommends. And so we try to look at education. We try to look at training and for food handling and these kind of things, any way we can deal with it. But at the same time, what we're trying to do is meet the needs of a changing and growing industry. And you see in Alaska, people wanting starting dairy industry, people wanting to make cheese, people wanting, you know, to own cows, to have raw milk. You have, like I said, gooey duck farmers now. You have a whole variety of new things. You have people that want to do onboard processing of salmon because it ends up with a fresher fish and sells for more. You have people that want to sell the whole crab rather than pieces of crab because the whole crab actually sells for more, even though it costs more to process it and tear it apart. But when you have a whole crab, you have the viscera, which has the parasitic shellfish toxin in it. I mean, so how do you deal with that? I mean, so you try to work with the markets. You try to work with the producers to adapt our program to their needs. And that's an ongoing challenge that takes a consistent dialogue, you know, with the producers. And
excuse me, Commissioner, I want the record to reflect that Senator French has joined us at 4:02. Thanks. Go ahead.
And just one example is on the gooey duck exports. These are large clams. You've probably seen them mm-hmm. down in Seattle. Those are harvested. There's a growing fishery in Southeast, both farming and wild-caught ones, wild-harvest ones. But what you're worried about is the shellfish, the paralytic shellfish toxin that can be in there. And it's a toxin that's naturally in the environment that's a result of algae that may be in the area. And so, and it's unpredictable at this point. It comes and goes. It can be in an area one day and out the next day. And there's federal limits on how much can be in the gooey ducks and still be safe to eat. And so we have to actually get a sample of the gooey duck. We have to send it to the environmental health lab. We have to chop it up. We feed it to mice and look how long it takes them to die. And we kill more mice than anybody else in the state. And one time we had a problem getting mice when mice got loose in an Alaska Airlines jet and hit a cable, but that wasn't our mice. But we had an interruption in our supply that affected our PSP program. But and we're looking for other methods that FDA can improve that we can not kill so many mice. But the point is that it has to happen within a matter of days. And then when we get the results in the lab, we call Fish and Game, and Fish and Game opens the fishery. They have 3 to 5 days to do the harvest, and we shut it down again. We have to start over with the testing because PSP can come back in. And so there's divers that have to go out there. They have to collect it. They have to get it to the lab. We have to sample it and get the results, or test it and get the results back. Fish and Game has to open it, and it just – and I know the legislators, certain ones, have been concerned about the cost of the testing, and it's heavily subsidized by the state. I mean, some of these areas it has to be. It's just trying us to work with industry, and this one's a work in progress. It's difficult. The Environmental Health Lab, it's in Anchorage. It's a real asset of the state. It's right next door to the Human Health Lab that Health and Social Service runs. It's close to the new crime lab that Public Safety has. In the Environmental Health Lab, some of the things we do there is, first off, what we don't compete with other commercial labs. And so if there's commercial labs there that do sampling all the time for mines and others that are trying to comply with permit requirements, this would be things that aren't available commercially, like PSP testing that I just mentioned. We do it. There could be tests that under federal law or state law have to be done by a government lab. They can't be farmed out to a private lab for security or other reasons. We also oversee other labs in the state, quite a few of them, and we make sure that we test them to make sure that their result, kind of results they're getting matched with the kind of results we get in our lab. And then we test for things like sulfalane in, say, in North Pole Refinery in North Pole area. You know, that's a new contaminant, and there's not commercial labs set up to kind of measure those kind of samples. So, you know, we might develop a method and do that testing. So we don't compete with commercial labs, which means there's a reason for that. Either they haven't established those methods, or it's not a moneymaker for them. So our lab's not a moneymaker. I wish it was. I wish there was a way to make that lab on a more sustainable basis, but it's just not set up to compete. So it's and the fees don't cover what we do, that we do charge. And so it's a big challenge there is with all the complicated equipment, the complicated work we do, all the certifications we need from the different federal agencies to have our lab certified to be able to make do the kind of tests that we do and have people rely on them. It's difficult, you know, with keeping that equipment up, keeping everything going. The state vet is also in the Environmental Health Division. He works at out at the Environmental Health Lab. Some of the things that the main thing he does, he's looking at for disease in animal populations. These would be primarily domestic animals, farm animals. There's animals that come into the state all the time, you know, for farmers and ranchers, and so be testing those whether to allow them in the state, working with the federal agencies on that, with Canadians on that closely. Works a lot with the farm community, the dairy farmers, livestock producers in the state, because the health of the animals and how that and gets into the actual processing to make sure there's not contamination in the food, works with our food safety program closely. Other thing that does is if we had a natural emergency in the state, under the state emergency planning, our state vet, DEC, would be responsible for animal care, you know, for the planning around that, for emergency response. Like you might have saw in New Orleans with all the flooding, what they do with all the dogs and the cats that got stranded, and we'd be the ones that would be figuring out the plan for that. And that's part of the state disaster planning. The other thing we do at the bottom, as I mentioned this a little bit earlier, is we collect fish. We work with Fish and Game on this and others around the state to get fish tissue samples. And then we test those at the lab for mercury and other contaminants that are present in the environment. And we're looking for trends there because we want to see if there's contaminants that can come in from outside the state that could impact our fisheries, our subsistence resources. And we need to evaluate that. So we have to have a good baseline and understanding of where it's at, where it's occurring, where it might be increasing. And we're one place in the world you can go for that kind of database. But to me, it's very important to maintain that. And that's, again, one of the kind of budget challenges that we have. We kind of look from all different sources of trying to find money to continue that fish tissue program. But what it does is it means, like, if our fishing industry gets questions about how safe Alaska fish are they contaminated, you know, we may be able to go to the lab and say what data that we have. We can show a whole track record of sampling our fish, and we know what's in them, and, you know. The other thing, like I say, one of the big programs of environmental health is the drinking water program. they don't actually construct these drinking water facilities. That's more in our water division. We'll talk about that later. But they oversee those systems. And the big challenge there is that if you're serving more than, basically it's 25 people or more, that under federal law you have to meet Safe Drinking Water Act standards. And periodically they come in with these new rules all the time, and they have one for lead, they have one for coliform, they have one for if you have a surface water source, and all these special rules. They had one for cryptosporidium a couple years ago. And these may arise as something that happened in the South 48, and then they started getting applied to every drinking water system in Alaska, and that's where we run into problems. And so we really are kind of the go-between between EPA and all these small public water systems around the state, and trying to do what's practical, meet the federal requirements that we need to meet. And so when any one of these new rules come in, it means that it just adds to our burden, because we don't have in most states, we just have our role would just be overseeing the different municipalities and make sure they comply with the rule. In Alaska, our job is trying to figure out how that rule can be applied in rural Alaska, then go helping those people, you know, right there, helping them to comply and doing what they can do to meet it, and talking with EPA. So it involves a lot more ongoing work. And once these rules come in, it isn't just one thing more on the checklist. It's actually getting out and get involved in the communities and working with them on their systems. And we're trying to get them to slow down on the rules. Other states are at this point, too, and I don't know what kind of success we're going to get, but we're trying. On the solid waste program, this would be the landfills around the state, and to some degree they call this the orphan child, all the sites that are out there in rural Alaska, the landfills. We would like to do a better job. I think some of the other federal agencies would like themselves to be doing a better job out there. But the funding that we get from the federal government for water and wastewater treatment is the same money that we would have available for solid waste. And if you just look at the human health aspects and the impacts and the risks, drinking water comes first, sanitation, and wastewater treatment, and then after that would come the solid waste. And so there's just you never end up with money for these projects, you know. And so it's what we're trying to do is be a little bit smarter in our approach on it. And so in the rural areas, which are what we call the Class 3 landfills, we're trying to just use best management practices. We're trying to make things simple, trying to work with them on the siting of the landfills, coming up with guidelines if you have a small spill in one of the villages, how you might be able to land farm the contaminated soil, and try to simplify the requirements around that, and trying to really deal with the real health issues and make it as least expensive and intrusive for them as we can and easiest to follow. On the larger municipalities, what we call the Class 1 and 2 landfills, those are pretty much 100% permitted. Those are, fully regulated. It's just the rural ones that are the child's, the orphan child's.
Commissioner, I note that we're almost about halfway through our time, and you have 60 slides, so we should probably be about slide 30 about now.
Yeah, and so we will speed up. We will go to pesticides real quickly. The big challenge I see on the pesticide program from the department is, and this is one where there's a task force that is chaired by DNR, includes Fish and Game and ourselves, and that's invasive species. And I think sometimes other states have had more of an impact from invasive species, but I think we're going to see more and more of that ourselves. We're seeing Elodia, which is an aquatic plant up in the Fairbanks area, and the Chinas slough, which just really clogged it up, affected fish habitat in a big way up there. We're seeing it also in some other lakes, Sand Lake around Anchorage. We're seeing it in a couple of three lakes I know of down on the Kenai. And so what's the approach going to be on these invasive species? And you can try to do mechanical removal, Elodia, that can break it up. It reproduces vegetatively. You can just end up spreading it around. It can be successful, but I worry that ultimately people are going to want to turn to pesticides, you know, for some of it. And so what's our plan going to be, and when will we allow it? What restrictions will we put on around it? But I see that as a looming challenge, and one that we're actively engaged in evaluating and discussing with other states. But I think it's partly warming environment. It's creating the new environments we create ourselves as we change our kind of living environment. It's a lot more transportation of people and goods and modes of transporting invasive species. It's just, it's with us. We're not going to escape it. So I'll skip on to marine debris. I know we need to cover this one. This marine debris was with us before the March 2011 earthquake in Japan, which was a tragedy, but we were seeing marine debris being deposited on the outer shores of the islands around Prince William Sound. We were seeing some of it in the southeast. It wasn't really hard to find. And it was coming from a number of sources, part of the mariculture industry in Japan, some of the fishing industry, including here in Alaska, just day boaters out there, too. And so we were already, there were different efforts to try, and there was volunteer groups that were out there trying to collect the debris. And then the tsunami hit. And so it just kind of, we had to ramp up, you know, what was already out there. And there was no state, there was no state program for marine debris at the time. And we were kind of dealing with it at the edges and, again, with the volunteers and that sort of thing. But there was no budget, no plan around it. And so the governor signed a executive order that put DEC in the lead among the state agencies to deal with marine debris. NOAA has a National Marine Debris Program, but it's a relatively small program. It's for the whole United States. It really had to ramp up for the marine debris. And so I kind of look at this as an opportunity, too, to bring more attention to marine debris in general. But for now, we have a lot more debris than we used to have that came in from Japan. And Alaska got more than its share of it. Most of it's been just solid waste. It's been a lot of styrofoam, polystyrene-type material, construction material, large floats from the mariculture industry. It hasn't been anything that's what we would deem as hazardous waste. Radiation has been a concern that people have raised, but one thing we point out to people is that the tsunami hit, and it washed up shore. It caused the damage, and the waters receded, pulling the debris back out with it. And there was the damage to the Fukushima plant, the power plant, nuclear power plant. But the radiation leaks and the water that leaked out of the plant, that didn't come till like 5 days or more later. So, I mean, the debris was gone. It washed out. And then you started having the radiation issues later. And so right there, you wouldn't anticipate that the debris itself, you know, would have radiation contamination. And that's what we're seeing. I mean, there's been people that are going out when they collect the debris, they take Geiger counters. What they're seeing is the natural recurring radiation that you'd expect out in the environment. But they're not seeing that the debris they're collecting there's a radiation concern there. And that's consistent with what NOAA and EPA and others have been advising, that there's not a risk there. But there is a lot of confusion in the public about radiation risks, and I can understand the concerns because it's one of those things you can't see and you know can have big consequences. But there's all sorts of exposure we get to radiation, both the natural environment and through medical procedures. And this just gives some example of what we're talking about. But people, I don't think, are that familiar with radiation and how it's measured and how doses are measured and how the human body may be exposed to it. And so it's really difficult when they think about radiation from the Fukushima plant to put that in context with what their exposure might be and what that risk is. And when we start talking about that, we talk about in units of measurement that aren't familiar with people. I mean, they're not familiar to me, frankly. And we're talking about such small units and how we convert units at the millionth and the billionth and the trillionth level and how you relate that to a dose that's relevant to people. I mean, you get more, this just shows that you get more radiation risk from eating a banana than you would a big tuna, you know, from from that area. I mean, it's just that's kind of levels that we're seeing. This gets back to the units of measurement and some of the confusion around that. So the, but Alaska too has, we don't have a radiation program here because we don't have nuclear power plants here. We don't have anymore with the military. They used to have small ones up here. But like the state of Washington with the Hanford and other states, they have radiation programs, California, Oregon, Washington. And so when you look at this map, what you see is the current, the main currents that come over to the United States from Japan, they come from the west, flow east, as you probably know, and they go to California, and then they start moving up the coast towards Alaska, and they circle around Prince William Sound and the Gulf. And so that's the path of the radiation debris that you would expect if there was any, that you would see it in California, you see it in Oregon, Washington, B.C., and then up to us. And so these programs that are along there and the federal programs with the state programs down there, they have been monitoring for radiation, and they're not seeing any levels of any kind of human concern. And so when we look at this, there hasn't been, we see a driving need in Alaska to try to institute a program, particularly where we'd be starting it from scratch. You know, so we're relying on NOAA, we're relying on EPA for their analyses with the data that are coming from the other states. So it's the reason, you know, when the radiation occurred, after the debris, the currents, the monitoring that's being done by other states and the federal agencies and their conclusions from that, that we haven't mounted up an Alaska program. And sometimes people say, well, why don't you go out there and just take a couple of samples to confirm it? Well, we have so much coastline, and where would you look, and where would you take your samples, and what would you sample for, and how often? I mean, we don't have any boats. It would be a tremendous expense for a risk that we don't see. I mean, it could be done, but is it worth the effort and the cost? That's the question. But we're going to continue to press the federal agencies and work with the other states to gather all the information to get it out to people and do our best analysis of it. We're working closely with Health and Social Service. They're the agency within the state because they do have people over there that are experts in radiation because of the medical uses. And we work closely with them on radiation contaminants, you know, what happens with it after the medical usage. So we know the people over there, and they're working very well with us on evaluating these risks. It's not just DEC. We're working with all these other partners, both federal and Human Health Service, Health and Social Service.
So, Commissioner, the question I get from constituents is that fish don't necessarily swim just based on the direction of the current. And so are our salmon swimming over near Japan and then coming back to us? With these states, California and Oregon, Washington, are they, and Hawaii, are they sampling fish flesh for radiation contamination? Or, I mean, how can I respond with assurance to a constituent who has this concern?
Yeah, they have been sampling fish, you know, in their areas and not seeing levels where they've been issuing warnings or anything like that. And the Alaska salmon, they just wouldn't have that exposure during their lives. I mean, you're talking about fish, like even close to Japan, that are being sampled. And Alaska fish just aren't going to have that same exposure, and for the fish that where we do have data on, you know, showing that there's not food concerns. So again, we're just not expecting it, and it worries me, frankly, when you see speculation because, you know, we sell our fish in the international market, and there's people that would love to disparage Alaska fish. I mean, we saw that right after the Fukushima incident. There was a delegation from Alaska over in Europe, and there was like this immediate response, don't buy the Alaska fish because of the radiation concerns. And we were trying to help ASME respond to that, where, I mean, it was just ridiculous. It couldn't have reached it by then, even if it was going to. But, I mean, it's just that we got to be careful when we throw things out there that we have an industry that's dependent on the reputation of our fish.
Sure. Senator Michiki, did you have a question?
Just a quick one. So, you know, where primary market fish are grown up in the Bering and such, other than ASME, who's not is a marketing arm, are you partnering so that we can send out a periodic message to the world that our fish are safe? I get the same questions from my constituents. I've had questions from markets outside of Alaska, and just curious who's grabbing the reins on that responsibility.
It's a combination. I mean, like Stephanie Moreland in the governor's office is watching fisheries and oceans and these kind of issues. There's the people at ASME that we coordinate with in our discussions. We talk with them regularly, so you know what they're hearing, what we're hearing, and what data we're getting. We have regular meetings that are set up through NOAA and FDA and all the others that I mentioned to talk about what each of us is hearing and what data is available. And it's somewhat unpredictable, you know, where the next concern is going to arise. And so, you know, it is kind of more response oriented. But if there's, but where we're ready, if we started seeing something more need to be done, we certainly gear up because we certainly understand the importance of maintaining the reputation of our wild salmon and other products up here.
Any other questions? Doesn't look like it. All right.
Okay, I will rush if that's okay. SPAR, that's our spill prevention and response. There's several programs: industry preparedness, prevention, emergency and response, contaminated sites, and response fund administration. And I think of this as a timeline. Industry preparedness and response, they're the ones there that are trying to prevent an accident from happening, a spill. Prevention, emergency response, they're kind of the emergency SWAT team that goes in when there's a spill. Contaminated sites, they're the ones that take over from the PERT people if it's going to be a long-term remediation or if it's a historic site rather than an emergency response. And then the response fund administration, that's the group that oversees the expenditures out of the response fund, which is our main challenge, the declining balance there, which I'll talk about in a minute. History preparedness response, contingency plans for certain operations and facilities in the state requirements that they have actual plans looking at their facilities and the types of things that they handle in their activities, how they're going to prevent spills, and if they have a spill, how they're going to respond to it and meet certain planning criteria, certain planning scenarios that the state puts out to them. And one of the things that we require under state law is that they actually be able to perform those plans. So you have financial assurances that are required. We do spill drills to determine whether they have the plans in place, they know their plans, and are able to respond. We do inspections to make sure they have what they say they have. We license oil spill primary response contractors. These are people in the state that industry relies on to help them with the response. They don't each need necessarily set up their own organization. They can have a contract with another organization that provides that service. And then what we do is, on our contingency plans, we're required by state law to evaluate changes in technology and apply the best available technology when sea plans come up for renewal. And so, for instance, we've had best available technology conferences recently on detecting corrosion in pipelines how we do that, because that would be real important as we go forward, like with OCS development. You have buried lines coming on shore from, you know, how do you inspect those, you know, when they're buried and they're offshore? So leak detection, remote monitoring, that kind of thing will be very important. Cook Inlet, a lot more activity there with exploration, new players coming in, so there's more sea plans when we have new people coming in, trying to make sure they're familiar with Alaska conditions. I mean, the Arctic gets a lot of discussion, but Cook Inlet's very challenging in itself. It has ice conditions, high tides, big fishery, a lot of challenges there. And so we've been putting a lot of effort into that. On the OCS, the Outer Continental Shelf, Shell is hoping that they would be able to get back in 2014. It's a little bit uncertain, maybe 2015. But they're certainly looking at getting back there in the Chukchi, at least. And so even though that's outside state waters, if you had a spill out there, it could move onshore. And they also have a fleet of vessels, a fairly large fleet of vessels they bring with them, that also have sea plan requirements around those. So it does end up being that they're state requirements. One of the ongoing challenges for industrial preparedness is we have aging infrastructure on the North Slope. That example, that was the two spills in 2006, the BP corrosion matters that, and so you know, we have aging infrastructure up there, and how do we test that and make sure we don't have other corrosion spills? And as the chair is very well aware of, we're involved in Arctic discussions, more activity in the Arctic for all of us, and how do we collaborate with other nations? Kristen Ryan, our director of spill response, she just got back from Norway. She's part of the state, the U.S. department, U.S. delegation on a new spill prevention work group that's going to come up with at least best practices, if not some kind of at least voluntary standards for prevention of spills for the Arctic. Our PERP division, these are the emergency responders. The big challenge there that I'm just going to get to, well, I want to cover this first. This is good background information. We talk about spills in the state, just kind of give you some context. There's about roughly 2,000 spills, reported spills in the state each year. That's what we deal with. Not all of those warrant an agency response. It's a smaller fraction of those, and even a smaller fraction where you might actually tap the response fund, you know, to help with the response on that. Most of those spills are to land, but there's some 344 reported spills to water a year. The types of products that are released, it's largely diesel fuel. I mean, ships going belly up, trucks rolling over, that kind of thing. Aviation, 13%, hydraulic, 7%, engine lube oil, 3%, gas, 2%, and other. Other would be things like produced water that might be used in mining or oil and gas, other operations. It would include crude oil. So you see from this picture, it's largely refined products that all of us use and that get transported all around the state and used in all different types of transportation and energy production. It's not crude oil. And if you think about it, what really pays for our spill prevention response division is the surcharge on crude oil. And that's one thing that oil industry likes to point out, is that they pay for everything. This is more of a historic slide. It shows the inventory of contaminated sites that we have, not just the ones from last year. That last site was just spills last year. This would be just the contaminated sites that are we have now. A large part of them, about half of them, are federal legacy sites. You know, they're not necessarily the big spiller these days, but historically that they're the ones that have accumulated half the pool. A third of our contaminated sites are private sites. So the state has a number of them too. One thing we're doing is we're working a lot with local communities to try to build capacity, because not every spill is a big spill. By and large, most of those 2,000 spills a year that are reported, those could be handled at a local level. We try to train people up. We try to pre-position response equipment, limited sorbent pads, boom, that sort of thing, so people locally can respond. And we enter into local response agreements with these communities, and then we come back to the legislature periodically every few years, usually for a request of around $500,000 to either put connexes of response equipment or upgrade or replace stuff that's been used around these communities. The other thing this does is it does provide some education for people about what's involved in a response, gives them better appreciation, more ownership in their communities. And if we had a big event, maybe the local people would have a better understanding of what's happening, and maybe if they're trained up, be able to have a better ability to participate and be involved in the response.
And one of the things I note, Commissioner, is between Kotzebue Barrow and the Canadian border, there's not much there, and that's one of the things the Arctic Policy Commission was recommending, is more deployment of equipment and training in those areas.
Yeah, we certainly welcome that, Chair Giesel, is that we are out in those areas trying to recruit interest and maintain that interest, and you know, as resources provide, we're going to do more of this. I see this as ongoing effort.
Sure. Thanks.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Secretary.
Just on that point and on that map, what jumps out at me is that there's nothing at Prudhoe Bay. Why is there nothing at Prudhoe Bay?
When you don't have a community there, and so you don't have a local group. I mean, that's one thing that I'll go off a little philosophical tangent here, but historically in the state, when we had large resource development projects, they have purposely not created a new community there, you know, because they didn't want to compete for the local resources with the local community. So you end up with these camps like Red Dog Camp and Dead Horse. And to me, it's kind of a trade-off because it means then you don't have all the public infrastructure that you normally would have. And so you end up with these camps with a bunch of different companies with their own facilities that may or may not collaborate, you know, on their waste and management and everything else. And so it's it's just managed how it is among the companies that are there. And there's like Dead Horse and these other places, there's no real agency, consistent agency presence. I mean, we don't have an office, big office up there. You look at the state office in Dead Horse for DNR, or Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, DEC, and, you know, it looks like a bunkhouse or something. I mean, it's just the way that it's historically been operated. It's not like if you went to Fairbanks, you see an office building with DEC's name on it, you see DNR's name on it. It's part of the community, and there's that infrastructure there and so forth, but everything's operated as a camp, even for decades, and these that's the way we've done it. So it's there's just not that local community, and so you have people coming and going that are, you know, in and out of the camp. And so what happens is you have an OSRO up there, Oil Spill Response Organization, which is a co-op that's funded by the major companies that operate up there, and they're a big organization, very skilled experts at what they do, and they're the responder. And then what you on top of that, what you have is great participation by the employees of the companies up there that get trained up as kind of the backup responders. But there's not a community, you know, it's just different. Now, one of the big questions I think the state faces is as you move towards work in the Chukchi Sea area, that's getting pretty far from Prudhoe Bay, and so you would rely on the OSRO there, Alaska Clean Seas, for some work, but it does provide the opportunity to involve those communities, you know, like Wainwright. And the question in my mind is how much industry presence will they want in Wainwright, which will somewhat determine, you know, the level of their involvement, not just in spill response, but in general. And it may be that there'll be a policy change there, or a different approach than we had at Prudhoe. So I'm just curious how that's going to evolve. But that's a long answer to an interesting question. I thought about that one.
It just seemed like, if I could just, thanks, Madam Chair, it just seemed like you have a round black circle that says non-state-owned response equipment containers. I just am surprised that all the gear that they have, the mountains of gear they have at Prudhoe, wouldn't merit at least one little dot to acknowledge it.
Well, it's also just the scale of it. I mean, these community connexes that you see out there, those are for the small local response. And so we're talking about specialized equipment that can, you know, that skiffs that can get in and out of the ice. So we're talking about people that's their job. And the spill response, it's the person that owns or operates the facility from which the spill occurred that has primary responsibility. They're the ones that have the duty to respond, the legal obligation. We don't respond to the spill typically. If they fail, then what we do is we can tap the response fund, and we can go in with the response fund and contractors. We would hire contractors then that would take their equipment in and do the response, and then we'd do cost recovery. These connexes are kind of just a small piece of what's out there. Most of the response capability is going to be in those organizations, those co-ops and companies that are around to meet our C-plan requirements that are required for industry.
Commissioner, these connexes are also intended to respond to the smaller spill around their fuel tank, for example, in the village. They're not going out to sea to put booms out.
No.
So
not. I mean,
there is a distinction there.
Some, yeah. But yeah. Most of them is that local immediate response that we're after here. Because those are the bulk of the spills. Those are the ones that are going to impact that community. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happens a lot is we have these natural events like the Galena flooding. Usually at the end of the legislative session, the thing that I'm thinking about is, in talking with emergency management, John Madden over there, is what's the ice conditions in the rivers? Are we ready for the next flood cycle? Mm-hmm. And all the different agencies really gear up, you know, around the annual flood cycle. And, you know, we're looking at not just fuel tanks. We try to get in there and get people to stabilize their fuel tanks and prevent losing fuel tanks, but how do we get in there and deal with it afterwards and other things? Galena was the big case. You can see kind of the before and after pictures. And but it's also drinking water wells. Environmental health is very involved in this, and it's just an ongoing thing, the natural disasters. We have a lot of groundings, fish vessels. We're dealing with a tug right now down by Wrangell. That's a reoccurring thing, usually in the summer, but down southeast you can have them all year. One of the things that's a big hot topic in Alaska is the use of dispersants. When you have a spill, the policy of the state is to maximize mechanical recovery, get as much as you can. But realistically, it's a relatively small percentage. Once you kind of lost already when you got the oil in the water, it's just how bad you're going to be hurt. And so you try to recover as much as you can, but the two backup options is to burn it. That's we saw a lot of that in the Gulf, in situ burning. You have a limited window of opportunity because you're going to lose the more volatile compounds as time goes on, and that's what's going to really get the heat to get the ignition going to deal with the rest of the crude. And so you have to make some of these decisions quick. The other thing is you can use dispersants, and it doesn't get rid of the oil or convert it to air contaminants, but what it does do is it disperses it into the water column and provides more opportunity perhaps for the oil-eating bacteria to do its thing there and hopefully makes a less of a response as the crude maybe washes up on shore into other habitats. And the big thing is protecting the shore. And there's all sorts of questions in Alaska, particularly in the Arctic, of whether that trade-off exists as it did in the Gulf, whether it might be better to let it go on shore rather than stay in the water column. And so there's questions around it, and DEC is working with the other federal agencies to try to address that. But you have to know what you're going to do in a spill in terms of dispersants, because if that becomes the option, and it could, in certain instances, the only option, you have to deploy it pretty quick because you have that time window, and then the dispersants may not be right there in the area. You might not have the planes or the trained people to deliver it. You might have to fly it from Kodiak. If it's up on the North Slope, that could take you a while. So, you have to make your decisions quickly, so it has to be part of your planning up front. And so you want to be talking with the communities and making these decisions before something happens. Contaminated sites, these are the cleanup people. I just wanted to show this slide. This was a success story in my mind back in about 2004 or 2005. We had closed more contaminated sites than we had active sites, so we were kind of crossing that line. So we're trying to keep the number of new sites down and dealing with all the legacy sites, including the federal sites. We have things still around like the legacy wells from NPRA on the North Slope. There's actually an increment on federal receipts in our budget this year of about $900,000, which is more federal money coming to the state to deal with some of these federal sites, which is good. Big challenge is the response fund with declining oil production. You've heard this before. That's the surcharge, the nickel a barrel that is split 4 cents, goes to the prevention account, which pays for the operations of SPAR. There was a surplus in that account historically that's offset the declining production, but at least by the end of fiscal year 2015, we're anticipating that, I'll explain this, but that's when we would go into the red. That's where, without a general fund increment, SPAR would not be able to maintain its level of services. And so if you're looking at going forward from about fiscal year 16, and it kind of depends, it might get extended a year or so, depending on some cost recoveries we have going on, it would be about in the range of $5 to $7 million a year that would be required to offset the declined production and it keeps bar. And that was just a level funding, assuming no inflation, no employee contract increases, anything, which is somewhat unrealistic, but that's kind of the gap that we're looking at. Quickly on the Division of Water, we have the facility program and the permitting program. I'll just give you an update on the 404 assumption. I think that's the thing you'd be most interested in. Last year on the assumption bill, what that did is it directed DNR and DEC to work together to examine the costs and benefits of the state assuming the dredge and fill program, the Clean Water Act 404 program. And if you put fill material into waters of the United States, you need a 404 permit. And since we have a lot of wetlands in the state, the majority of the state, country's wetlands, 404 is a big program in this state. And so it's is there ways if the state did take primacy of that program, which we're allowed to under federal law, could we make it more user-friendly for people in Alaska? Could we not lower the bar, per se, but run the program in a way that makes more sense in the state? Kind of along the lines Senator McGuire mentioned earlier. One of the ideas is on mitigation. There's a no net loss policy in the country. So if you fill in some wetlands, you've got to replace it with additional wetlands. Well, here there may not be that opportunity too readily, or you may be on the North Slope where you have millions of acres of wetlands. And would you rather go in and try to reclaim some wetlands and add it to the millions of other wetlands just like it? Or could you do something about those legacy wells as part of your mitigation? And so we're looking at a state if there's more opportunity, still all around water quality benefits, and then ways of doing mitigation banking and in lieu programs and stuff so that people don't have to scrounge around for mitigation projects and do something that may not make a whole lot of sense in the grand scheme of things. And also looking just performance and all that. And we're getting a lot of collaboration from the federal agencies, both EPA and the Corps. We've hired the people that, and we have two people from DEC that are now housed over at the Corps of Engineers that are participating in the review and issuance of permits and learning the ropes over there. We have ongoing meetings with the state of Oregon. We've met with the two states that have primacy, Michigan and New Jersey. They're very doing very good a job of sharing their experiences with us. So next year we're going to do our initial report to the legislature and I think have a lot of good information to provide. Ultimately, though, it's going to come back with a final report and recommendation to the legislature, and you would make the decision whether you want to fund the program. We'd have to come back. You know, we don't have an appropriation to run the program, and until we have the resources to run the program, we can't even apply for primacy. So I keep assuring the legislature, you're the gatekeeper. We'll be back and with a recommendation, and I don't know what that recommendation will be yet. The other challenge, as mentioned quickly, in the Water Division is in our facility program and Village Safe Water. Those are the water and sewer projects that we fund in rural Alaska. Our federal money has been going down precipitously. We rely primarily on federal funds. It's 75% federal funds, 25% state match. And that's been going down. It's about down to about 60% in the last 10 years or so. And so we're trying to look at ways of doing things smarter in the villages. We have a project right now that is out there that we've put a RFP out to form teams of engineers and others that then are proposing ideas on projects. We're going to try to select some projects and see if there's ways of combining existing technologies, looking at new technologies to deal with some of the unmet needs in the villages at lower cost, both construction and operating. And we're teamed up with ANTHC, Alaska Native Tribal Health Corporation, EPA, USDARD, Department of Agriculture, which is one of our big funders, and a number of hosts of different other agencies, CDC. I mean, everybody's interested in this project. It's called the Alaska Challenge Project, and hopefully be able to report more on that in the next year or two. So I think that's the presentation.
Okay. Questions? Senator Machiki.
Cruise ship regulation changes. Last year we made it so it wouldn't change, so mixing zones are not allowed. When we got to the next reg change date, if you will. So mixing zones are allowed. One of the things we talked about is that they wouldn't be allowed in critical Kishmeck Bay critical habitat area. Have those regulations been drafted yet? It's a question I get often.
Senator Machiki through the chair. I think there were several questions in there. So the current status of it is that HB 80, what it did two basic things. It took the general permit that was already out for cruise ships that was due to expire in 2013 and extended the termination date to 2015. Because otherwise it would have meant that that permit would expire and DEC had lost its authority, or we would have had to require ships to meet water quality criteria at the end of pipe, which they couldn't do. And so, I mean, that would have kind of created a crash. And so the other thing it did is allow DEC to issue permits in the future following our existing mixing zone regulations. And so we've been working on a draft permit for the next cycle. That is, there's a draft that's in internal review right now that is based on existing mixing zone and other water quality standards that we anticipate going out for public review. My goal is to try to get it out in time so that, assuming it gets through the whole public review process and we don't run into things that we missed or something like that that are deal killers, that it would be available at the start of the 2014 cruise season. Now, if it doesn't get, if it can't make it through that process and it, you know, there's concerns raised or there's things that we missed or things that need to be added or whatever, we still have the existing permit that stays in place. I mean, that goes till 2015, so we'd have time to go back and work more on it. So that's where the permit's at. Now, I don't recall that we were going to go back and do a reg change to deal specifically with the critical habitat areas around the state. Those are designated by Alaska Department of Fish and Game, as you know. And there's one in Kachemak Bay, which is, I think, the one that you're most concerned about. There's others around the state. My understanding, though, was that there wasn't any discharge in Kachemak Bay this summer. I think that was the agreement. I don't think there was any discharge. That was my understanding. But let me follow up on that, and I'll get you more, because I was focused on the permit. I don't remember any discussion we've had internally about any current reg package that would deal specifically with that issue you mentioned on critical habitat areas.
Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
Yes. Do you have a map of the Superfund sites that you can get online?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, Superfund sites are designated by EPA, and there's a federal process for doing that. There's just a handful of those. We could get you a list, and I think that there's probably locations associated with that, some kind of information, whether it's a map or whatever, I don't know, but we'll try to get you a link to that. But those aren't designated by us. What happens when EPA proposes a site, they'll ask for the state's opinion on it, but they have their own process for designating it.
I can find that.
Yeah, it's just a handful in the state.
Further questions for the commissioner? Great. If not, thank you very much, yeah. Commissioner, for this overview.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
In closing the meeting, our next meeting will be this coming Friday. We'll hear an overview from the Department of Natural Resources. So if there's no other comments from committee members, we stand adjourned. The time is 4:00.